I'm Marty Moscoe. Welcome to Radio Times. Imagine being 5 years old and forced to flee alone from your burning home, walking for days, even months on end, hiding from soldiers and wild animals, being hungry, exhausted, ill, and afraid, and after years of living in refugee camps, being given political asylum in the United States. That, in a nutshell, is the life story of our guest, Michael Majok Kuch, one of the 4,000 unaccompanied Sudanese minors who were called the Lost Boys. He went to school and college here in Philadelphia and now lives in Juba, South Sudan, where he's an advisor in the office of the president. Harriet Levin Milan met Michael when her creative writing class at Drexel University interviewed Sudanese refugees for an article for a local newspaper. They became friends, and she interviewed him for her new book, How Fast Can You Run?, that's both a novel and based on Kuch's life. She said she was struck by his sense of optimism, which reminded her of her family and friends who had survived pogroms and Nazi death camps. They both join us on Radio Times to talk about Michael's extraordinary life, what it tells us about survival and resilience. Michael Majok Kuch, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Margaret, Marty, for having us.
You're very welcome. And Harriet Levin Milan, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you, Marty. It's a pleasure to be here.
Harriet, I'd love to have you read a section from the very beginning of the book.
Okay. What happened next, he would take back if he could. A hot gust rose. It brushed his arms and chest. The hut he was hiding behind exploded into flames. Smoke seared his eyes. He ran as fast as he could, springing out in one long jump after another past smoldering huts as a sour odor, burning flesh, spread through the air. The soil he kicked up sprayed his legs. He dipped with the ground and entered the bog. Crocodiles lived in these shallows. Roots punctured the soles of his feet, ripping open the wound in his heel. Splashing his feet and pulling them up through the mud, he ran after Manion through water, reaching above his ankles, then into bottomless channels, mud clogging up his nostrils and ears and crusting his eyelids, every muscle in his body straining to reach the opposite bank. "How fast can you run?" his mother had asked, stroking his head and kissing him. She told him that he must run very fast, but she didn't tell him that Arib, armed with AK-47s and RPGs, would attack their village that very night. They were cattle herders, but he was small enough to slip past them.
And that's Harriet Levin Milan reading from the very beginning of this book. And Michael, the he is you. This is your life story. How right. much do you remember of that moment when you were 5 years old and forced to flee from your village?
I definitely vividly remember what the life was like in the village, in our society. As a young boy growing up, you are taught how to become a useful member of society. So you are introduced to some of these survival tactics at the beginning. I remember well when I was just in the village with my family, I was learning how to go goat herding. I would
go hunting.
Go hunting and do goat herding. I would go with goats with some of my cousins and learn how to fish off the Nile. We'll go and we have a net called a boy and bait. It's a hook. I was being introduced to some of these activities at that age. That will all be interrupted. Before that, I was to be initiated from being a boy, small boy, to adulthood, to become a more useful boy in the village and be given different responsibilities. Mm-hmm. That was all interrupted because of war. I was not able to go through all that.
Yeah, so on the one hand, you had some of these survival skills, but right. then on the other hand, you were just 5 years old.
Exactly.
And you were on your own.
Right. So once the war broke out, I had to now learn how to survive by myself. And that meant to collect the wild fruits. We had to gather wild fruit to survive off. It meant if you had no water, you had to eat mud just to quench some the thirst you might have had. It also meant really fighting for yourself, at times fighting people and trying to get something out for yourself.
I'm curious for you, Harriet. I mean, you know Michael very well, but what it was like for you to write this book, and perhaps it's being an outsider's or maybe a Westerner's or an American view of a small boy, a five-year-old boy, having to fend for himself.
Mm-hmm. That was the reason I wanted to tell the book through him and in his voice, because I didn't want the filter of the American point of view. I wanted it to be direct. So when we met, we first got to know one another. I went to Michael's apartment. He came to my home. He met my family. I wanted to cook for him. We did things together for many months, and then we decided to start writing. And in that situation, we would sit together. I remember it would be afternoon, maybe 1 o'clock. We'd be sitting on his couch, our shoulders slightly touching, and by the time we were done, it was dusk, and then evening, we'd be sitting together for hours and hours. And we did that several times a week for years.
For years. Mm-hmm. And this all began with actually an event here in Philadelphia, mm-hmm. One Book, One Philadelphia, mm-hmm. That told, in a sense, a kind of refugee story, not obviously from Michael's perspective, but from a different perspective.
I'll never forget the day that Jerry Truskin called me in my office at Drexel University, because it changed my life. She had an extraordinary request. She wanted me to choose 10 of my creative writing students to interview 10 Sudanese refugees for a city paper article. Actually, many articles would be serialized. And this was because One Book, One Philadelphia had chosen Dave Eggers' What is the What? And Patrick Rappa, who was the editor of City Paper, had this idea to follow through the book with these testimonies. And my students at the time, Drexel now, is very international. Students come from all over the country. But at that time, a lot of the students came from small towns outside Philadelphia, like Allentown and Bethlehem. And the question was, how would these students be prepared to do this? So I was teaching actually Paulo Freire, radical pedagogy, the pedagogy of the oppressed. And I was actually teaching them in my courses to be compassionate listeners. So I thought they were very prepared, and they were. And we all met together in a Starbucks at 34th and Sampson.
And here we are, right?
And here we are.
And so do you feel how critical is that, do you think, to certainly hearing someone's story, but then to be able to tell that story, be a compassionate listener?
That was very important. Again, for the students, were being trained not to insert their own point of view, but to get the person who was being interviewed to get their point of view across.
And Michael, what has it been like for you to, in a sense, tell your story to Harriet?
So as you mentioned earlier from your question, it's true that we met through One Book, One Philadelphia project. I had already been talking about South Sudan before I met Harriet, going back to high school days, where I participated on human rights conferences at the United Nations with an NGO called Global Education Motivators, mm-hmm. Affiliated with UN system. So I was already talking a lot about the situation back home. When One Book, One Philadelphia came in, where What is the What was chosen as the One Book, One Philadelphia reading for that time, I would be participating also along with my friend Valentino, who the book was written about. So that's where Harriet had me and called me, and I did not hesitate. I came down, we met at Starbucks. We talked about the article where they wanted to interview me. After that interview, it became quite clear that to me, I wanted to not only write about the article and talk about the situation in South Sudan through video conferencing, but also I felt that I wanted to talk to Harriet about the possibility of writing a book, writing my life story. Mm. And it was from that moment where we are today that brought us to How Fast Can You Run Today.
And I hate to use the word therapy, but has it been helpful to you to be able to tell Harriet, and also to have people read about your life, to put some of the difficult times in your life into some kind of perspective, and to get a response from the public?
Absolutely. Therapy can be a good word. To me, when I've talked about this, my experience as a young boy growing up, as a refugee child, or in an IDP camp, internal displaced person camps in East Africa, it comforts me. It if you wish, it's a form of therapy for me to know that people know about what I went through.
That you're known.
That they know me. They know the kind of life experience I went through. It is easy now because of the media, technology. We can now see about Syria now. During my lifetime, my boyhood, when I was a boy, nobody knew anything about what was happening in South Sudan. And especially when we were in IDP, internal displaced person camps. These were within the country, concealed off from the neighboring countries. And that is where the most horrible atrocities take place. Nowadays, you have refugees crossing over to other countries, and it is known. You have the technology. So I want to be able to talk about, and I am doing it not only for myself, but for some of my friends who did not make it. So that at least his story was known. To me, it was very important.
Harriet, there's something you said that really struck me in getting to know Michael and even writing this book, which is that you were struck by his sense of optimism. Mm-hmm. But also it reminded you of people that you knew that had gone in a different time and place, had gone through what could be described as trauma.
I had always been obsessed with my grandparents' immigration because I knew nothing about it. I don't know.
They didn't talk about it?
They didn't talk about it. My grandfather was in his early 20s or late teens when he came here. He never talked about it. I don't know what pogrom he escaped. I don't know if he was carried out in the back of a truck with, you know, in a hay wagon. I have no idea. I've met people who's, you know, with missing fingers because they didn't want to be conscripted by the Russian army. I have no idea. I don't know what his language. He didn't speak Yiddish with me. I don't know what his real name was. I mean, I really know nothing. And I was always appalled by the disappearance of that story. In school, I became a Russian major. I mean, I read everything I could. I had to take courses in Jewish history to find out about pogroms and why they came here. There were 2 million Jews who came here between 1880 and 1925. So when I met Michael, it was weird, but I felt like I was meeting my grandparents' young selves. And my grandparents and other relatives who came here had this very buoyant spirit. I had one aunt, Aunt Annie. I consider her a tzaddik because she would never say anything negative about a person. If anyone gossiped or said anything negative in her presence, she would spit and she would say, God bless America. And Michael was the same way. I mean, even now on this trip, if I'll say like, oh, this horrible thing happened, he'll say, no, Harriet, it is not horrible. That struck me. And I also found it with other refugees I had met.
But is that because they know horrible? Maybe in a way that we don't know horrible.
We could ask Michael, but I did some reading on it, and I found out Terence Dupriz writes a lot about the anatomy of the survivor, and he makes a distinction: survivors' spirits are intact. So in the book, the quest for Michael's mother, the yearning for the mother, was when I first met Michael, he hadn't seen his mother in 22 years. So for me, that became immediately the arc of the book.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Michael, I know you want to say something. Talking with Harriet Levin Milan, her book is called How Fast Can You Run? And it's based in part on the life of our other guest, Michael Majok Kuch, who at the age of 5 years old had to flee his village in southern Sudan, spent years in refugee camps, came to the U.S. after the U.S. gave political asylum to about 4,000 unaccompanied minors from Sudan. We're going to take a very short break and get back to our conversation. Stay with us. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. And we are talking about Michael Majok Kuch, his life as a refugee. We will be talking about his settlement in Philadelphia, his reunion with his mother after something like two decades of separation. He has since returned to South Sudan, works in the office of the president, and he is a subject of our other guest book, Harriet Levin Milan, and the book is called How Fast Can You Run? I should add that Harriet teaches creative writing at Drexel University. She's a prize-winning author of 3 books of poetry. Michael, we were talking about survival. And one of the things that Harriet writes in this book, there are many moments in as we follow your life where you do have to make a choice or a choice is made for you. And obviously you did survive. One of the things that Harriet writes is survival is a choice in the pitch darkness, in that you don't know what is the right thing to do. But you have to choose something. Can you talk about what you have learned about survival?
Yes, so as I mentioned early on, the sort of the upbringing I had was full of riddles.
Riddles.
In the sense of a life, not in the sense of the story as a riddle. For example, as a boy, I would take goats or calves to grazing to the nearby Nile. When you take them for water, the chances are you have crocodiles there in the Nile. Or you take them to further to a grazing land, the chances are you might encounter lions and hyenas, and you will have to try to save your livestock. There was also cattle rustling from the neighboring communities. For example, in my village, there's a certain tribe that borders my immediate village, and they would come and shoot people and take your livestock. So we were always confronted as growing up with some of those survival experiences of always encountering adversary. When I would be separated from my family, it was almost second nature. I had to know how to make fire, how to get water underground, what kind of wild fruits to eat or leaves to eat just to survive, and how to walk long distance without any adult supervision. So these are some of the tactical way of life I had to adapt early on. When I became refugee in IDP camp, of course, I had to learn how to survive also without adult. We were given, for example, a ration of food. You are given a cup of corn or maize for 2 weeks by the United Nations. You had to try and utilize that amount of food before the next distribution, or else if you finish, you will not have food for the next the whole of the next time. So these were some of the survival skills I had to adapt early on.
Were there moments you, though, were afraid? I mean, in spite of the fact, I mean, here you are again, a little boy. Yes, you know how to deal with some of the adversity, but at the same time, you don't have your family.
Exactly. So there were very scary moments. Of course, when the war broke out, when I would not find my family members, that was scary. And there were times when I was indefensible. I couldn't find things that I needed. And of course, yeah, there were those moments. I wish I was my family.
Yeah.
But you had to get out of that sort of mindset quickly in order to make it to the next hour to be able to survive. So a lot of optimicity. You had to be optimistic in order to survive the next moment.
Sort of the things that you have to tell
yourself.
You
have to
leave
behind
right?
quickly and move.
So don't have those bad thoughts,
right,
that kind of thing.
Right,
that
right.
kind of thing.
Exactly.
Harriet, I'd love to actually have you read another section from the book. And I do want to talk about the title as well, but let's have a reading.
Okay. No matter what age Majok was, whenever he found himself running, he tried to avoid getting stuck in the back with those too sick to run. When he was 5 or 6 or 7 years old, as he was now, those he started out with were other small boys. He outran them and moved as fast as he could and breathed in and out in order not to get a stitch in his side. He knew he could not look back and see the fire where the market stood. He didn't think of what could happen if a stray bullet hit him or if a wild animal, itself fleeing, appeared before him or if a bomb exploded right in front of him. All the while, he heard gunshots and saw the flash of fur, and he felt the heat rise across his chest, knowing what he left behind him. He lifted one foot after the other and concentrated on going forward. That is what kept him believing that he would survive and that he was going to see his cousins and brothers and mother.
And holding on to that thought that they were somewhere where you could find them. And safe, I guess, hoping that that was true.
Right.
Why the title of the book? We were talking about this before going on the air. How fast can you run?
You know, we played around with a lot of titles. We had some very poetical titles. One I loved was Shake Loose the Scorpions. And actually, that sounds like it's happening to people in a different country. I wanted this title to make very clear that this event could happen to anyone. The unspeakable could happen at any moment. Somebody could come through this door right now. And refugees are not other. This country is built on refugees and immigrants. We're all one people. So we very much wanted the title to reiterate that.
Yep.
And And then Michael has some.
Yeah, go ahead, yeah. Michael.
Yeah, I think so. When we came to the conclusion with the title, How Fast Can We Run? It wasn't easy initially. We were trying to capture what best title could we capture my story. Of course, Harriet, as a writer, had her own reasoning. I had my own reasoning as somebody who's a story being
told. It's your story, right?
So we had that, and the title she mentioned was one of the titles we sort of debated about a bit, how Shake the Scorpion Loose. It had a resonance to my life also in the village. We had scorpions. And, of course, when the scorpion gets into your beddings, you have a big serious problem.
So and you really want to run, right?
Shake it loose and all this.
And scorpions appear many times in the book.
Yes.
The title, How Fast Can You Run? To me, I became satisfied with it in a sense that it really described my life. I've always been running. Whether be it the physical running from attacks on our village, from wild animals, to refugee camps, fleeing, running very fast to come to America, and coming to America and try to catch up with everything in life. Yeah. My life has always been about running. I came here, I want to play sports in school. I did that for 8 years.
You're a soccer player,
yes.
Right?
I also worked 2 jobs at a time, and that was all meant to catch up with a lot of things. And so I became satisfied with the title, How Fast Can You Run? Because of what it describes about my life in general.
Let me give out the phone number, and it's 1-888-477-9499 to join the conversation. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Excuse me, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Describe, you were in several refugee camps, as we call them, or I guess internally displaced people camps, or some version of that.
Right.
What was the best and what was the worst of those camps?
So, at least in the IDP camps, and I'll talk about two of them. In IDP camps, they were better. Being an IDP camp, because you could easily trace your family members.
IDP meaning
internal displaced person camps, IDP camps. These were within South Sudan itself, but they were just at the border points, neighboring other countries. But at least you could easily try to trace some of your family members. Whereas in the refugee camps, you went to a completely different country. On one hand, you are more safer because you are protected by the host countries. And that is technically how you become a refugee. So once you cross your national border. Whereas in the IDP camp, Khartoum was constantly bombing us. And it was really difficult because people were maimed. People were bombed by Antonov planes. And you couldn't go to school. So those were difficult moments in the IDP camps.
Where did you get an education, though? I mean, I know you got here in Philadelphia, but even before you came here.
Yeah, so in IDP camps. So both in IDP camp and refugee camps in Ethiopia. I went to Ethiopia in 88. I went to school there, primary school. That was interrupted because there was a military coup in the country. At the point, this is when the Mengistu Haile Mariam was ousted and Meles Zenawi came in. So we had to walk from Ethiopia back to South Sudan to an IDP camp at the border called Pachala. There in 1991, we were bombed by Khartoum planes daily. So we had to flee again. We had to walk to the neighboring Kenya. In Kenya, we went to a refugee camp out of IDP to Kakuma refugee camp. So I had done school bit by bit. There were interruptions, but I continued until in 2000, right. I got the opportunity to come to Philadelphia for more of a formal education that was uninterrupted for 10 years.
And we'll pick up on that. Harriet, when he says walk, he means walk.
Right.
Hundreds of miles.
Nearly a thousand, right.
When you add it all up.
Right, right.
And by yourself or sometimes with other people?
Just with strangers. You know, I'll follow some people. Sometimes I know people along the way. You lose sight of people you knew, but you walk with anybody who's walking.
There's a scene in one of the refugee camps or IDP, I think it was a refugee camp where you saw a white person for the first time.
Right.
I got a chuckle out of that. Can you describe that for us, Harry?
I had to put that in there because he was telling me, you know, as a white person, we see it through the white person's point of view. And hearing a non-white person say that they were seeing a white person for the first time was really wonderful to hear and really interesting. And he, I'm pretty sure in the book it says that he saw the long, the person's long nose.
Yes.
That he was talking out of, that he would eat out of instead of using a straw.
Can you expand on that, Michael?
No, it was very strange.
It was a congressman, right? Was a member of Congress?
I think so. It was one of the delegation from the U.S. government that were trying to bring the humanitarian aid to the boys. And yes, I had never seen a white man before that, so I think the description Ariad gives me, I didn't know it was a human being.
Was really, really white, right?
And he talked about the pink skin like a pig.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Now, you did find your siblings. Where and how did you find them?
So over the years, in the last camp, luckily enough, in Kakuma, a refugee camp, we were reunited over the years with some of my brothers. Not all of them. But I was able to reunite with three that I came to Philadelphia with. I come from a big family. My father had four wives, so majority of the kids have not been reunited. But at least four of us were lucky to reunite throughout the last years in Kakuma, and we came to Philadelphia with.
And were they just there at the camp by coincidence? Or
different times, by coincidence at different times, because we had no way of reaching, getting in touch. There were no phones. So you can write letters. A lot of time they get lost. There was no real formal way of communicating. So that made it a lot difficult to trace each other.
So how many years had it been before you saw your siblings?
So some of them I didn't see since 1987. Some I saw, and then we got separated again over in different camps. So, yeah, it has been always like that.
For example,
I saw my mother in 2008. I have not seen her since then until now. That's 8 years later. I forget these other people in different parts of the world in Africa.
Yeah. It's extraordinary to think about that, Harriet.
And what's so heartbreaking is Michael was at Kakuma refugee camp for years with his mother, unbeknownst to either of them. She found out that he was there the day after he left. There was a piece of paper posted of the names of the people who received political asylum to go to the U.S., and she saw that list the day after he left.
And I know there's a whole story about how you were able to track her down, but you did, finally,
right.
Your mother.
Right. And that was fantastic for me. And I know not all of my family have been reunited. But it has become what is our life now. We had to accept it. That is what our life became. But the good feeling is knowing now we can meet. Even though it has been difficult to still meet, unlike before when we didn't know each other, where each other's whereabout was.
Yeah.
It is better now. We know at least you can visit one another from time to time.
So where did you find your mother?
So I went to, in 2008, through help of some high school students, university students from Harrington High School and Drexel University. We organized, and through Harriet and her family, they organized a reunion project. This reunion project was aimed at not only reuniting myself with my family, but as a legacy, to be able to raise enough funding for the lost boys and lost girls of South Sudan in Philadelphia area and beyond, to be able to reunite with some of their family members who have not either seen their family since they were children or for a very, very, very long time. And some of it has been achieved where a number of guys and have been able to go back and reunite with their family.
I mean, yes, we have the internet, but it's a big world out there, Harriet.
It was pretty amazing. Well, my son Josh heard that Mike hadn't seen his mother in 22 years. This video game playing son actually dropped his remote control and ran to me and said, "I don't know what I would do without you, Mom." And after Mike left the house that night, he came upstairs to my husband and me, and he said, "We have to do something. I have a special teacher at school at Harrington High School, Dr. Terry O'Connor, and I know she would love a project to help reunite Mike with his mother." So we did, and the reunion project was born, and we had so many fundraising events. Drexel, we had a readathon, we had Jam for Genocide, a hunger banquet at Harrington High School, different things, and we helped reunite four families.
And able to, and was it a matter of sort of knowing where people were, but figuring out how to get them together, or was it still tracking them down?
Well, what was really interesting was we had people who wanted to reunite with their families in Michael's community write essays, and the peer reading tutors at Drexel University actually got the essays first and would meet with the applicant and help them revise it and give them feedback on the essay. And then they would resubmit the essay, and then we formed a board and we would choose the winners.
Wow. Mm-hmm. And what did your mom look like when you finally saw her after more than 20 years?
I must say she looked good, but she looked a bit older.
I bet. Maybe, and you too,
maybe,
right?
I don't look like a baby to her. I was when she was.
Sometimes for a mom it's always a baby, but that's all right.
But yeah, she's doing well now.
And she's doing well. So do you feel like you're, as you said, it's a large family, but do you feel like at least some of the family is intact together?
Yes. So traditionally, being I'm the firstborn from my mother's side, of course, we have this traditional culture. The family is never intact unless they're under one compound.
Ah.
So I remember when I was growing up, of course, my father had four wives. They were all in one home. So even though you'll have your house there, you'll have one compound. Then he will have his own by himself. So as kids growing up, we would visit each other. That was, to me, a nuclear family, even though it is still extended family by all standards international. But for us as Dinka board, the family is intact only when you see everybody. So that's the challenge. We are not able to do that. And hopefully in the future, we will be able to unite our family.
And that's Michael Majok-Kuch, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. Harry, Levin Milan with us as well. And the book is called How Fast Can You Run? It's part novel and part based on Kuch's life as a refugee and coming to the United States, which I do want to talk about after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Michael Majok-Kuch. He was 5 years old when his mother told him to run from their village in southern Sudan that was under attack. He spent days, months walking from refugee camp to refugee camp and ended up in the U.S., one of 4,000 unaccompanied minors given political asylum. This was back in 2000 for Sudanese refugees. He went to school and college here in the Philadelphia area, lives now in Juba, South Sudan, where he works for the government. Our guest, Harriet Levin Milan, has written a book about Kuch's life called How Fast Can You Run? She teaches creative writing at Drexel University. She's a poet and speaking tonight at the Free Library of Philadelphia. And you can speak with us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can also tweet us at WHYY. Radio Times to join the conversation. Michael, I've always been uncomfortable with the phrase the lost boys. And this was the phrase used to describe you and other young men from Sudan who were here in the U.S. as unaccompanied minors, as refugees, finding political asylum. Do you like that phrase?
It's a great question. When we came here, we were not even called the Lost Boys. Before we came to America, the UN agencies, humanitarian organization, used to call us the unaccompanied minors. We were minors, but not accompanied by adults. So that was the name we had to deal with in the refugee camp. And you had to go and say, I'm an accompanied minor. This is my unaccompanied minor card in order to be given a food ration. When we got here, the Americans were looking for a story, how to describe us. And I remember very well the name. I asked, what is his name, Lost Boys? Because we didn't know when we came. I was in the first group that arrived in Philadelphia in 2000. And they would show us newspapers of other places. So I remember there was a group in South Dakota, New York. We were coming in different cities at the same time.
Right.
And they came up with the name Lost Boys. I asked how. They said, because there's this story of Peter Pan. And I had no clue what it was. But quickly, we had to adapt to the name. Everybody, because it was on TV, it was in the newsprint. So we accepted the name. I accepted it. I don't think I'm any longer a boy now. So I always tell people in the recent days, you can call me now the found man.
From lost boy to found man. I mean, this is what we often do. We shorthand things, Harriet. But there's something off-putting about that.
In the book, we minimize the use of it. I used unaccompanied minors. I used a member of the community. And what was really mind-blowing for me was I had heard the story of the lost boys when Michael reunited with his mother. My family and I went on the trip, and Michael invited us to come along. He told me his mother made the same journey. So hearing about the lost boys, we think it was just this group, this adventure of these boys. This is the journey that every refugee, the Syrian refugees are making it now. Every refugee makes this journey, and I think it minimizes this ordeal by calling this, by picking out this group. Yes, they're special. Every group is special, but
right.
No one is more special than anyone else.
And it's nothing to do with Peter Pan.
No,
just say that.
Not at all. There's one scene in the book when someone says, "Oh, you're a lost boy," and Michael's thinking to himself, "I hope she read the article about the conflict and not the article about lions attacking us," because again, you know, this really minimizes the story.
You know, Michael, I'm trying to imagine just what it was like for you to fly into Philadelphia, having lived the life you lived, and come to our fair city and to see the plenty, perhaps to feel the cold,
right.
And to try to acclimate yourself to a really foreign, alien environment.
Right. It was actually very foreign for me. It was actually very terrifying when I arrived. I know, given all the bad things I went through in the refugee camps. Mm-hmm. But when I came here, I came here in November of 2000.
Cold, right?
Very cold for me, too cold. We arrived into New York City. And from New York City, number of hours, right? Some people were going to different cities. You don't know. You just say bye. You don't know who is going where and if you will talk to them again. It's just like our other journey, right? You separate with others and you don't know when to see them. I came to Philadelphia with my brothers. It was about 15-minute plane ride. First of all, when I arrived in New York City, it didn't look like I was in the wild. It just looked like I was in some different world, with all the lights, street lights, and cars, and planes, and people. And
you never,
it was overwhelming.
Like,
never saw it before in New York City, and it was cold also. So to me, I don't know what I was feeling.
Did you think, oh my gosh, is this really what I want
this
for myself?
This is not what America I was thinking.
And I know there was a scene, you're living with a family, you go to, I think it's Walmart, and just, you know, get jackets and clothing and, right. and things to keep you warm.
Exactly. We were terrified by the cold and the whole culture, the food culture, you name it, the being busy now, having to go to work and go to school. And I mean, it was a total life change for us in the beginning. But we adopted eventually.
Yes, yes. And I guess luckily for you, you had some of your family. I mean, you were together with some of your siblings, because I'm trying to imagine coming to the U.S.
Right.
and not having that.
Right. So when we came, we stayed by ourselves, and we had a number of friends, American friends, who would come and help us, check on us, just help out with the cultural orientation. But yes, that was very useful for us. It was very instrumental that we were staying with my family.
I mean, Harry, it's interesting to talk to Michael and to think about, as you mentioned, the Syrian refugees and other refugees from other more sort of war-torn parts of the world or conflict-ridden parts of the world that want to come here and want to, in a sense, do what Michael and his siblings did, which is to both get an education, get some jobs. Some of Michael's family is still here. He went back to South Sudan, but this is... It's an interesting time to be talking about all of this.
It is. And I think the political asylum of the so-called Lost Boys is the most successful story of immigration in history or something. So many of them, as Michael said, have adopted and succeeded, have become doctors and lawyers and professors. There were some members of Michael's community who were students at Drexel University who I met. One recently got his PhD. He's a professor, an engineering professor now at the University of Nebraska. So, and a lot of it depends on who you meet, too. Lutheran Services was an incredible agency for Michael and his family and friends to meet, and the people he met helped him tremendously.
What did you, coming here, as you said, it was in one of the camps, I guess in either Kenya or Ethiopia, where you saw your first white person. But what was it like to come to this country and meet African Americans?
So when I first arrived here, my brother and I were very interested in going to school. And I remember having to meet the white family. I met them first time at the airport. They were waiting for us with our names on a signpost at the Philadelphia International Airport. Picked us up. By then, there was a rectory by a church that was prepared for us to go and spend that evening. So thereafter, this was a family, a white family. I did not meet African-American initially. It was through this family that I wrote also a letter to go to be allowed to go to high school. And because this family was white, they knew only this, well, not only this high school, but they directed me to apply to one of the high schools in Philadelphia. And this was a school I would apply, LaSalle College High School. It's a prep school. It's a Catholic, all boys. When we got there, there were no African Americans.
It was all white?
It was all white, very expensive, and rich kids go there. And so in the eventually, from there, I would also. So when I grew up here in Philadelphia, I went to Chestnut Hill, and I was not as exposed to all the, depending on which kind of neighborhood, which neighborhood I was staying. I lived in Germantown Avenue. Some of the people were very welcoming. I think the majority of Americans, when we came, because they heard our story, most people were very welcoming. There were challenges, of course, not being an American or African-American at the same time, just being an African, that was quite a challenge. But I was very busy playing football with a lot of my friends, and that sort of kept me going.
Sure. Yeah. And football, we should say, we call it soccer.
You call it soccer, yeah. I have a problem with that.
But it sounds like you were a very good football player, a soccer player. There is an incident, I mean, near the end of this book, and this really happened to Michael, accused of really sexual assault at his college. He was suspended. There was a trial. Can you flesh this out for us? All right, and then I want to hear from Michael.
This was one of the reasons that Michael wanted the book written, and I think it really just shows the racism and discrimination in this country. Because he was an African, he was easily, you know, picked out, and this false charge was made against him. The case was thrown out. It was completely false. I bought the transcripts, so I read both two books of them, so I know. The case was dismissed, and Michael, in fact, became the speaker at his mm-hmm. college graduation, and the college was very, very happy that to have him speak and to help him get with graduate school, the recommendations and so forth. It was a very, in the book, I sort of equated it with an emotional exile. As in the beginning, he fled from his country. He dreamt of arriving to a place where he would experience freedom, and then he was banished again.
And banished again. Did it feel like that for you, Michael?
I think it was surreal for me. Initially, it was surreal in the sense that what the accusation itself.
The accusation, right.
But when I was actually undergoing the trial, I realized that this thing was actually serious than what I had imagined. What became hard was to be able to divide the school and the accuser. I didn't want to stop my classes. The school was came forward and said, okay, what we'll do, we'll continue your classes off the campus, pending the trial. So that to me was good. So my studies were never interrupted, and that's why I finished within 4 years' time. It was just a semester. Yeah. Then after the trial, I went back on campus. The accuser was expelled from school. Yes, in a way, it made me not trust America initially, because until you hear what my story was, nobody should have come to a conclusion that I had to go to court. Mm-hmm. But the way the system was set up is you have to go through the other, you have to undergo the court. Then once the court tells you are not guilty, then you are fine. When I was saying I was falsely being accused. But it wasn't as compared to the other trials I've been in life. I guess because I did not know if it was the opposite. If for example, it didn't turn out the way it turned out. So in the book, I wanted that story included. Why? Because it was also my experience of trial, beside my life as a refugee in Africa. So I wanted this story included, as part of my story in America, as part of my life experience here.
A false accusation. An email from Patricia. I still have two high school graduation cards for him with cash. Seriously, I met Michael on a few occasions as he went to the same high school as my son, Robert McNamara. I used to tell my son that for a birthday or Christmas gift, all I wanted for him was to track down Michael for me so I could give him these two cards that were never sent to him. Anyway, I still have the cards in the cubby over my desk. Who's Patricia? Do you know?
I do know her. How are you? Rob, I say hi to you guys. It's been a very long time indeed. I do know her. I know them very well. Very good family.
Oh, that's really nice. Now, you live now in Juba in South Sudan. This is the youngest country in the world.
Yes, that's right. The newest country in the world.
And having its problems, I should say.
Yes.
Do you worry for your country?
Well, we definitely have challenges, and since I've been back, I just went back a year before independence. I went back in 2010, right after graduate school, and ever since I went there, we've had challenges, especially if I have to compare with the life in America and how you have more established system, and we got independence a year after I went there, and so many challenges from development. We don't have roads. John Garang used to say we never had roads since time of Adam and Eve.
From Adam and Eve.
We never built hospitals. We never had schools. You have to imagine, or you have to remember, we came from a failed state. We were one Sudan with Khartoum. We fought ourselves for a very long time until they granted us a referendum, which decided our independence. So we had to start everything from the scratch. And all those challenges have been there, developmental challenges, and our own internal conflict also. So we've had a number of different fighting in 2013, 2 years after independence, and then the recent one in July. As we speak, the government is trying its best to put together a peace plan. There's an agreement being implemented as we speak. So we just hope that the peace will be sustained and so that the country can get back to development plans.
Well, I hope so, too. And it's been such a pleasure, Michael, and I wish you the best. Thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Michael Majok Kuch, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. Harriet Levin Milan, thank you for joining us as well. And her book is How Fast Can You Run, based in part on Michael's life. She teaches creative writing at Drexel University. She's a poet, speaking tonight at the Free Library of Philadelphia. And I should add that Michael lives now in Juba, South Sudan, where he works for the government. My thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out much more about this program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. And we did take some photos of our guests that you can check out on Facebook. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thanks for joining us.